Hello.
Hello.
My name's Will.
And I'm Matt.
And this is Season to Taste. Oh, we do have to do it at the same time, don't we? That is as far as the budget stretches, is us both saying the title at the same time.
And there's a budget.
And my not very good.
Why was my agent not informed of this?
Because then you'd have to pay 10%. And also, because we spent all the actual budget on the exciting theme tune. Next episode, we'll be featuring the Will I Am remix. Unfortunately, this episode, you just get the current theme tune.
The Howl tune.
It's not even Peter Howell. It's not even that good. It's not even Dominic.
We couldn't even get Howell round to do it.
So this is Season to Taste, and for the new listener, or fraction thereof, we are celebrating Doctor Who's 50th anniversary year by watching one story from each year that the series was on the air. We're very busy people. We don't have time, like some, to start at the beginning and work all the way through. And also, that would mean watching a lot of stories we just don't like. So we'll be celebrating the show we love with one story per season.
Yes.
You were going to butt in. It was just to confirm that what I was saying was the truth.
Yeah, I was trying to give you a verbal hint to chivvy it along, rather than getting distracted like last time.
This is the second time we've attempted to do this intro, because I just went on a lot of, I'm doing it again. Now we've done a lot of stories so far, this is being episode 12.
13.
We've now watched 12. 11 stories, and the most recent, the one we chose in the last episode, is Warrior's Gate. As usual, I'll ask you, Matt, how did you find Doctor Who and Rorvik and Hopkirk deceased?
I
be glad I said deceased and not e-spaced, which was my other version.
Oh, it's classic, is this?
Every time you say that, I cut it. Which is about six times. That's another classic joke, Will.
This is turning to arsenic and old lace, isn't it? Rather than a podcast.
Less of the old. More of the arsenic, please. Anyway.
Ask me again, and then we'll do it properly.
No, we'll just carry on. What did you think of Serial 5S?
I enjoyed it. What did you think, Will?
I thought it was one of the most confusing Doctor Who stories I've ever seen. I liked it in a lot of respects, but given that we've already watched for season 26 Ghostlight, in comparison, Warrior's Gate was confusing.
Yeah, I agree, but I think it's a better kind of confusing than Ghostlight. Confusing in a good way, in that it's like that Russian film Solaris. You get the idea that there's quite a lot of deep ideas behind it, and the author, Stephen Gallagher, is a proper science fiction writer, and it does have that slight sense of someone who's caught up in their own fascinating noodlings on scientific ideas. I didn't entirely follow it, I'm with you on that one, but I thought the imagery of it and some of the ideas that I did follow were very fascinating, and I really enjoyed watching them.
Yeah, one of the problems I think it has in doing that kind of hard SF, and in a way I think it's in a sense less interesting than some of the other stories in season 18, or at least further removed from real science. Like, Full Circle is about evolution.
Yeah.
Legopolis, although it's not real science, has quite interesting ideas about the power of maths to change the universe and things like that. But this is a very broad, vague kind of, well, there are some timelines, and or they insist on calling them striations.
Yeah.
I don't feel like it's talking about real science at all. It's more just kind of creating a concept. One of the problems I think it has, having done that, is that there is no one in the story to explain that to. The TARDIS crew are the Doctor, Romana, mathematical genius Adric, and intelligent robot K-9.
Mm-hmm.
And they all just witter sci-fi terms at each other and deliberately long words. And no one asks what anything means. Is that kind of what Barry Letts always thought was Le Shaw's problem, that there was no one to say, Doctor, can you explain? And they all just spout at each other, and it's hard. No one says it, you know, what do you mean by a striation of time?
Yeah.
They just blurt it out and go, oh, yes, of course.
Yeah, it's a very cold story, isn't it? It looks cold, and it's got that kind of very austere look to it that I don't know why. Season 18 to me always feels very cold and austere. I think it's because it's full of stories like Warrior's Gate or Legopolis.
It's not very character led. It's very story led, and it's very concept led.
Yeah.
But consequently, you don't tend to have memorable characters, and you don't have characters that you engage with and are really interested in. But, you know, Rorvik is an interesting character.
Yeah.
But he's not someone you empathise with.
No, but then I think they do make an effort to make it empathetic, so you can sympathise with the Tharyl's plight. And what I thought was really interesting was the way that Beorhok starts off as someone who is relatively sympathetic. He's being captured and tortured by the privateers. He then escapes, and then he helps the Doctor to escape through the mirror, and he seems to be a good character. And then you see, actually, he comes from this race that used to be terrible oppressors.
I do like the idea that rather than just a straightforward, oh, this race has been enslaved by this race, it's a complete turning of tables, and the Tharyls were just as bad as the humans when they had the power to be.
And I think, you know, the striations aren't just of time, but there's that striation of good and evil, of empires rising and falling. And I think it gives the sense that it's quite a layered and thoughtful story, which has a... It does have a kind of a weight to it, even though it takes place on a very, very small scale. I mean, a couple of sets and no real sets other than the spaceship and the gateway.
Yeah.
Everything else is photographs or blue screen.
I think one of the reasons that it's much weightier than it seems is because it's made of dwarf star alloy.
Could be, yeah.
I like that it's a very non-traditional Doctor Who story, although there is a villain. And they were kind of monsters. It's similar in a way, and it's a slightly lazy comparison, to The Mind Robber. And that kind of just blankness and odd situations arising and just cutting off from any kind of sense of the real world. We talked about survival having a real foot in the world we know, and council estates and real people, and you couldn't get further away than Warrior's Gate. It's not even a recognisable planet, it's not a space station, it's a kind of concept of a place that they're wandering around in, and you have to kind of go with it. One of the things I like about it that I felt makes it maybe not that different from other science fiction, but certainly different from Doctor Who science fiction, is, well, there's a couple of things. One is that the crew on the spaceship are a bit shit.
Yeah.
And there are other crews that are sometimes a bit like that, but there's a real... You know, Warwick's the captain, but he has no authority really at all, and everyone just ignores him with his own problems at the end. You know, that actually does affect his character.
Uh-huh.
But you have the below decks characters who, you know, the same kind of characters we see in old episodes of Star Trek and Babylon 5, but in this specifically, you know, they also a couple of fairly shit crew. Well, none of the crew are particularly good at their jobs. They're basically the temps who've come in, so the other members of the crew look down on them. They don't care about their bonuses, so they haven't got this, they're not invested in the same way in the project.
They're kind of like the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern characters, aren't they? They kind of poke ironic commentary on the rest of the plot while trying not to get killed off, and I think it works really quite well in this.
The other thing about the crew compared to a lot of when Doctor Who tries to do futuristic sci-fi stuff is no one fortunately has a stupid costume. In Warriors on the Deep, everyone has these awful jumpsuits.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, we don't really know what time period the crew in Warriors came from, but they are just basically given straightforward orange coveralls, and Rorvik's captain's outfit just looks, you know, slightly naval or slightly military. There's nothing...
Probably designed himself, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly, to make himself feel more important than everybody else. By not trying to do, let's make it look futuristic and sci-fi... It actually feels much more real and grimy and dirty. And it's a lovely ship. This multi-levelled ship set is really nice as well. It has its problems in that, for a start, the things on the upper deck shake quite a bit.
Yeah.
And it's as if someone pushes too hard, the whole set moves. And you get the studio floor on the lower set.
Yeah.
And controversially, you get the studio lights when it's shot up above, although I think that works quite well.
Yeah.
I don't actually think it's a problem, but you've got the nice grating and... perhaps because they didn't have to have lots of other sets, they're allowed to have quite a nice, complicated ship set.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the look of it... I think one of the reasons why I enjoy watching it so much is that it has such a distinctive look, and they use all of the tricks that they've learned with the new digital technology that they've got in 1980 to have...
It's Quantel debuggery, isn't it? They're pressing every button they can find.
But they've also... I think it... uses the scene sync CSO method, which allows a better integration of model sets and backgrounds with actors, and they used it in Meglos, and I think they use it here for when the Doctor and Birok and Co are walking around the black and white Tharyl mirror universe,
which looks really good. It's a very arty, astonishing, isn't it?
It's like watching an early 80s pop video, like Ashes to Ashes or something. That look, and I think, and
it reminds me of Moondial a bit as well.
Yeah. But I think as well, because the story is so elusive and strange, it's a bit like Ashes to Ashes in that sense as well, in that I want to try and understand it, and I want to rewatch it because I think it's quite interesting. Mm. It intrigues me. I think it's really well directed. I think it's very dynamically directed as well a lot of the time. There's lots of point of view shots, like when Romana's being menaced by the revived Tharyl.
The cliffhanger at the end of episode 2.
You see from Romana's point of view her struggling and trying to escape from her bondage chair, and you see the Tharyl coming through the door from its point of view. I think that's really quite tense and quite dynamic.
You've got right at the very beginning, you've got this really long tracking shot around the ship, just taking it very, very slowly and establishing where you are. There's lots of nice moments like that and nice bits of direction. I mean, we were discussing that, you know, there were small parts of it that were directed by Graham Harper because the director, Paul Joyce, was sacked and then re-employed shortly afterwards again. And so there's tiny bits where Graham Harper stepped in to direct as production assistant. And I was saying that if, you know, I don't know what Paul Joyce's direction is normally like, and if you'd just shown me that episode and I didn't know which stories Graham Harper directed, but I've obviously seen some of them, it felt a bit like a Graham Harper direction, some of it. And I first wondered whether, well, is that because I'm just happening to be watching a bit that he's done? Or is it actually that part of his style, the things he's picked up from working on shows like Warrior's Gate, and he's seen what can be done by Paul Joyce and has noted that down and used similar ideas later?
Yeah, I think that's a good insight. Did Graham Harper direct Army of Ghosts and Doomsday?
Yes.
Because the other thing that was occurring to me while I was watching it is that, given that it's the other story that finishes with a companion having to get trapped in one universe while the Doctor goes into another, there were visuals that just strangely reminded me of Doomsday. And I think, you know, that chamber in Canary Wharf in Doomsday, that kind of white blankness.
It's quite like Warrior's Gate, isn't it?
Really reminds me of Warrior's Gate and the kind of
people
the mirror
just appearing
wall
and disappearing.
And the Doctor on one side of the mirror and Rose on the other side.
In Doomsday, they hold hands with the people with the big yellow buttons to jump through to the parallel universe.
Yeah.
In Warrior's Gate, they hold hands with the Tharyl to travel through the time winds or whatever it is they're doing.
And perhaps there's something around the direction gives me a subliminal link as well, but I was watching it thinking, this does remind me strangely of Doomsday. But I think the main thing is that weird blankness outside the gateway and the weird blankness of that kind of void chamber in Army of Ghosts.
Which is actually in Army of Ghosts, it's just that Tracy Ann Sideman hasn't got around to getting any pictures up on the wall. They probably haven't been there that long. Or Torchwood's art budget is low. Speaking of the companion departure overlap between the two, obviously we have Romana's and K-9's departure at the end of...
Oh, K-9's so annoying in this, isn't he?
K-9's annoying a lot of the time.
But in this in particular, it sounds like Christopher Bidmead has just made K-9 say lots of sciencey things like, oh, the angle of reflection is equal to the angle of incident, or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And he just witters on all the time. I know he's supposed to be going mad a bit because of the time winds damage to his memory circuits or whatever, but he is particularly irritating in the way that he just natters on about science all of the time.
Oh, well, presumably Kenneth Cope felt the same way about K-9 as he throws him across the room, which is actually one of my favourite K-9 moments now.
I think probably all of the big guest stars that season only agreed to do it if they got to abuse K-9 in some way.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't Bill Fraser?
Is he
General Grugger? Yeah. Bill Fraser allegedly said he would only do it if he got to kick K-9 in the story.
And for all it's discussed in earlier stories about Romana not wanting to be dragged off to Gallifrey when she gets back to Edenspace, and although it's set up with K-9's damaged memory circuits, it's still quite abrupt when Romana just suddenly announces again she's leaving.
It's really abrupt. She just kind of says, oh, I'm not going to go with you. And the Doctor says, oh, all right then, here's K-9, bye.
You expect it to be. You expect Elise to make a big fuss about, well, Kaylan's going to have to stay, so does that mean someone's going to stay with him? Or a discussion of, well, now we'll get back to Innerspace, and Romana's saying, well, I'm not going to risk that. But she just, it's just quite a sudden, yeah, I'm not going.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's referred to in the first episode, I think they mentioned Gallifrey again. But I think, you know, if you were watching this as intended, that would have been a month before the last time it was mentioned. And the last time a big deal was made out about it was 2 or 3 months before. So, you know, I think the last episode really required a bit more about why Romana can't go back to Endspace. Mm. And I think it's quite often a problem in Doctor Who later on, that because the writers are writing it in a chunk...
Well, the writers often write the story without the companion's departure being part of the story, so it's not in there when they write
it. I don't mean even the companion's departure, I just mean in general, the way that it's written, people who write it or make it forget that if something's mentioned in episode one, actually that's quite a long way for the audience from episode four, and it's actually not really acceptable to have a major plot twist in the fourth episode that is only referenced mildly in the first.
Although I think it does give you more scope to, you know, do your Chekhov's gun by saying, well, actually, I can be fairly explicit about something in the first episode, knowing that many, you know, deliberately hoping that the audience will have forgotten about it by the end. But then when they're reminded of it, they'll say, oh, yes, actually, I did see that.
Chekhov's hexachromite.
Chekhov's hexachromite. Chekhov's a big fan of War of the Deep. And then he died. Yeah, but it does happen. It happens a lot. You know, that sudden companion departure where it hasn't really been planned for and suddenly it's necessary to write out an actor and Leela suddenly marries Andred, or Sarah just gets dropped in Aberdeen. Mm. Or Tegan just turns around and says, oh, it's not fun anymore.
Yeah,
and you go, well, right. Well, you've been acting like that for the last 2-3 years. why this week? And yeah, you think, even though Romana gets a little bit more, and there's a few different shots, and a little bit of walking to the distance, and the Doctor commenting on it, and it's quite, I do like the line about him saying she's going to be superb, it's quite touching. It is still quite out of the blue, or out of the white, when it happens. Romana herself, I think she's one of the reasons why it is a bit cold. I think Romana too is a bit of a cold fish. But she is quite fun and tricksy in Rory's game, particularly early on. She has some nice banter with the rubbish crew, outsmarting them, and even at the end, having her banter with the Doctor and Adric about who's going to stay in the TARDIS and who's going to go and try and stop Rorvik.
Mm. She does suffer from... She's a cold fish. Because I think first episode where she goes outside the TARDIS to find out what's going on and gets cornered by Rorvik's men, and she does her funny hand signals to Adric, and I think she is tricksy, I agree with that, but she's kind of charming and kind of cute as well in it. I think her a bit less cold than the first Romana.
Really?
I think the first Romana is very aloof and standoffish, and I think the second Romana is a little bit more, she still has that upper class raised eyebrow to her, but I think she is a bit more game to pitch in than the first one.
Oh yeah, she's certainly more inclined to get involved with things. Yeah, I find as slightly charmless is too far, but I
don't think she's.
It might be that we towards the end of the story, which obviously we watched most recently, compared to the beginning of the story, as you were just saying about the gap. I don't remember her smiling, any point in the last episode. Mm. You see, there's that kind of thing. It just doesn't. There's a lack of warmth in the character. At least I felt it in that story, anyway.
Okay, it's an interesting one. I'll have to watch some more Romana, I think, because, well, we'll definitely see it when we do season 17, won't we?
But yeah,
an interesting point of view that I've never really thought about before. I do, in general, I think Romana of either Tam or Ward varieties is a slight mistake as a companion. I don't necessarily think it was ever a good idea to have two Time Lords travelling together with no one else. And their magic mechanical dog.
Yeah, well, there were two time brains in the circuit, a little overload.
I think it has the tendency to make the whole series a little bit, give it the risk of becoming a little bit aloof and
cold. Well, the companion is the viewpoint character for the audience, and you take it, at least originally.
Yeah, and not in the 70s, I wouldn't have said, but...
But it's, the audience like watching the Doctor, yeah. But they don't want to be the Doctor, they want to be travelling with the Doctor. I mean, it's obviously a massive generalisation, some people want to be the Doctor, you know what I mean? People want to go and have adventures with the Doctor, so they want to be travelling with him, and... It is the companion's job to ask questions, and Romana, one in particular, can ask questions like, what is rain? But she's not going to ask something technical and scientific, because she's going to boast that she knows more than the Doctor does.
Yeah, I suppose. I suppose by the 70s, actually, the show's gone on long enough that you don't really need a viewpoint character in that sense to get you into the story. So Romana frees up, I guess... the storytelling a little bit by having two people who are as smart as each other, and you therefore watch because there's two people as smart as each other having fun together.
But it's always nice for the dynamics of the show to change, so it's nice for there to be a period where the Doctor can banter with someone on his level if he doesn't last too long. But also, when you say the show's been going long enough, the audience comes in a cycle, so although there might be some people who watched it at the beginning, there'll be lots of people who only just started watching and reached an age to start watching.
Yeah.
And there'll always be a need for someone to bring them into the story.
I think the Doctor and Romana, particularly Tom Baker's Doctor, has a tendency to kind of look at stories a little bit from the outside in as well, in that he can pass a bit of wry comment, and he always gives the audience the impression that he's in on the joke with them. He'll talk directly to the audience as though he's acknowledging he knows he's in a TV series, and isn't it all a bit of a lark, and isn't that monster a bit rubbish? And when you get Mary Tam and Lala Ward doing the same thing, I think it almost becomes like the Avengers with Emma Peel and John Steed, when actually they're very fun to watch, but it's not necessarily a recipe for great drama.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, Romana's other massive skill, we mustn't fail to pass comment on, is in episode 4, where she magically makes a pair of chopsticks appear.
Well, she's wearing that kind of Chinesey tunic, isn't she? So maybe she's got a few more things up there. Maybe she's got a wok in there as well.
She stayed behind in eSpace to open a takeaway. And that probably explains the Ferrells, because of course they have those lovely chow mains. What else did I want to comment on? I thought actually it's interesting about the Ferrells' language, and I only picked it up once, and I don't know if it was there a bit more. But where the Doctor and Birol go through the mirror and they're talking about his hand having been caught by the time winds, and Birol tells him that it's healed, except he doesn't say that it's healed. He says, it will be healing now, which is a complete mess of tenses.
Uh-huh.
And I wondered whether that's a very deliberate use of language to try and imply that the Farrell's time sensitivity means they don't quite follow time in the same way.
Mm.
And so he knows what he wants to communicate to the Doctor, but his participles aren't quite right.
Hmm.
I don't really notice it elsewhere. I would have thought it'd be a more obvious thing, not that I wasn't really looking for it, but I certainly noticed it there. I thought that's an interesting misuse of tense that perhaps ties in with his time sensitivity. One other thing I noticed was at the end, the Doctor has his slightly scrappy fight with Warwick, where Warwick's trying to choke him with the scarf and Romana's trying to attack Warwick with a clipboard. It's quite a comic fight. But you do kind of think, actually, in nearly 7 years of Tom's time as the Doctor, it's surprisingly rare for someone actually to try and choke him with his own scarf.
On screen, anyway.
you did say it was John Nathan Turner's wish fulfilment when we were watching it. And so you mentioned J&T. Obviously, it's J&T's first season as the producer.
Yeah.
And he has redone the title music, changed the costume, and it's interesting that Tom's old costume is hanging on the ubiquitous hat stand in the TARDIS console room. But it's that title sequence that you kind of forget exists, don't you?
Yeah, I said when we were watching it, it's like the Blake 7 season 4 title sequence, because the rest of Tom's era has the Time Tunnel title sequence. I always find it, you know, straight away, literally the second that the episode begins, you know that it's got to be from season 18.
Well, it's like the season 11 Pertwee title sequence, isn't it? You suddenly go, oh, hang on, where's the funny wobbly lines? It's a giant full-length Pertwee flying down the time tunnel.
Yeah.
But yeah, it somehow doesn't quite suit Tom. They're so used to...
Yeah. I don't have that same thing with the Pertwee time tunnel. I think maybe because Pertwee's other titles lasted 4 years and Tom's have actually lasted 6. I mean, it's just a huge break, isn't it, with the Time Tunnel title sequence.
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah. But yeah, it's, and I don't think it's a particularly flattering picture of Tom they use in that.
No, I mean, I love the actual music itself. I think that's the music that I first remember when I watched it, and that kind of opening scream, I just think it's brilliant. I still think it's the best opening to the titles. But the actual images of the Starfield and the kind of neon logo do look a bit naff, if we're honest. They're not as imaginative and inventive as the Time Tunnel.
They're very much, there's something very 80s about them as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to say about Warrior's Gate?
I kind of agree with you. I still am slightly baffled whenever I watch it, but every time I watch it, I notice something else that I enjoy. And I think, unlike Ghostlight, which we were quite critical of because we thought it was a mishmash of ideas that didn't really hang together, I think the interpretation and the effort you have to put in is merely to try and get the script to make sense because it hasn't quite been written and edited to scratch. Whereas for Warrior's Gate, I think it's deliberately that elusive and difficult. And I think you can watch it very superficially and laugh at the funny men and look and kind of go wow at the pictures. But unlike Ghostlight, it also repays a bit of closer attention to try and interpret the stuff about the I Ching and the thing about doing nothing is a positive choice rather than having to do something. That final episode is all about Rorvik going on about finally we're getting something done versus Birok saying do nothing.
Yes, it's a like critique of that kind of government. Something must be done. This is something.
Yeah.
So we must do this approach. That's what results in them all getting blown up at the end of Warrior's Gate. Yeah, I enjoyed it. As I said, I liked maybe a warmer central cast or someone who would at least require an explanation about what's going on, because I think you might end up understanding. I do think it owes it to the audience to be slightly more explicit about what it's trying to do. And things like the Gundans are never really properly explained. They're kind of, at least why they kind of randomly come to life and who built them, why they were built. There's kind of mentions of it, and there's just such a mix of odd things happening. I'd appreciate just a bit more of an explanation. Someone in the story to even want an explanation. But it's enjoyable. There's nice lines. It looks really nice. Mm. And I'm certainly very glad that the show, as it often does, tries something different.
Mm.
And, you know, it doesn't work perfectly, but I'm very glad that it exists and they gave it a go.
Mm.
So it's time to think about what we will watch next.
Woohoo!
As always, we will refer to the randomizer to pick one of the remaining seasons from us. Statistically speaking, a Tom Baker season is still the most likely, but we still haven't done a Hartnell story, we still haven't done a Peter Davison, and we still haven't done David Tennant.
Mm.
So let's see what the randomizer has in store. Well, well, well.
That's three wells in one sentence. Makes you sound very well.
Makes me sound very well connected with a water source.
Yes, it does.
And if it were a wishing well, and if you were wishing for a William Hartnell story, then you'd be lucky because we've got season 2.
Oh, excellent. And the good news about that is that only 2 episodes are destroyed from that season, never to be seen again. So,
although by coincidence, someone did bring around some. They look like film cans for you the other day. I just chucked them out back.
Oh no! I sent them down the dump.
Yeah, I thought they were probably rubbish.
It didn't have those 2 episodes of The Wheel in Space that I've always wanted to watch in there. So you know, who wants to see The Power of the Daleks? Sent a whole lot down the dump.
Cool. You did save those episodes of The Sky at Night, though, didn't you?
Yeah, those 2 classic episodes.
Yeah, those are pretty cool. So that's good. We don't have to deal with, unless we go for the Crusade, we don't have to deal with telesnaps and audio and the like. So we've got quite a number of different stories to choose from. Planet of Giants, Null Invasion of Earth, The Rescue of the Romans, The Web Planet, The Crusade, The Space Museum, The Chase, and The Time Meddler.
Yep.
Some of those perhaps more familiar with than others.
Yeah. So, if we get kicked off, I'm going to start on a slightly negative note again, but it helps to narrow it down. I'm very familiar with the two Dalek stories from Series 2, and I have no real desire to watch any of them at the moment, so I'd like to opt out of those, please.
Okay. Dalek Invasion of Earth was a bit of a classic. The Chase has things going for it, but yeah, I'm quite happy to skip those. The two that I would lean towards, and we can discuss the others as well, but the two I'll put an early pitch for are The Web Planet, which we were talking about a couple of episodes back.
Okay.
When we were talking about the fish people and comparing them to the...
Zabi? Dance of the Monoptera.
The Dance of the Monoptera. I say Zabi with question mark because I haven't seen that story, which is why I'm tempted. And the other one that I haven't seen from Season 2 is the Space Museum. I actually don't really know what happens in them. I've seen even less about the Space Museum, apart from a picture of William Hartnell inside a Dalek. That's all I know about it.
I don't think you would be much the wiser after you'd watched them.
let's not spoil them.
Okay.
We'll allow the stories to do that themselves. So we've also got Planet of Giants, which I haven't seen for years. It would be quite interesting. The Rescue I love, obviously only two episodes, but I do quite enjoy. The Romans is an absolute classic, and I would happily sit through that. The Crusade, I've seen the existing episodes of, but I don't think I've ever listened to the missing episodes, and I've never read the novelisations, so that would be interesting. And the Time Medal, I think we can pull the Time Medal out. I've watched that really fairly recently, and also because it was part of that 90s repeat season.
Mm.
It's one of the first Hartnells I saw.
Yeah, I'm happy to kind of rule out the Time Meddler on the basis that I like it as well, but I'm not desperate to rewatch it, and I have probably seen it more often than most of the second series.
Let's rule out the Crusade on the basis that we'll watch one that exists.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. And I'm kind of tempted to rule out The Rescue and The Romans on the basis that because I like them and I've watched them so much, it's a bit lazy just to say, I'll pick The Romans.
So does that leave Planet of Giants, The Web Planet, and The Space Museum?
It does.
And The Space Museum is four episodes, of The Web Planet six, is that right?
Yes, and Planet of Giants is three.
I would suggest, and you having seen them may have a different view, that we go for The Space Museum, because I would like to take the opportunity to watch a story I've never seen.
Mm-hmm.
And The Web Planet has such a reputation, it might just be a Vaseline-covered lens too far. But I'll give it a go if you want to go for that, but I think maybe The Space Museum.
If I were going to pick one of the three, my top pick would have been Planet of Giants.
Yes, I could tell that was the case.
Just because if I was going to watch one story with giant insects in that series, it wouldn't be The Web Planet.
It would be the one that's half the length.
Yeah. But mainly because it's another one of those stories that I've seen, but I haven't really paid much attention to. And every time I see photos of it, I think, God, it was pretty fantastic. Mm. That does. I'm surprised I've never really paid any attention to it.
I love the novelisation of it.
Yeah, the novelisation's really good. It's Karen Stick's late one, wasn't it?
Typically, I've read the novelisation of that, but the two stories I haven't seen, I also haven't read the novelisations of. I really don't know what happens in them.
But on the basis that you're keen to watch the Space Museum, and it'll be a whole new experience for you, let's go with that.
Cool. Serial cue it is.
I'll cue it up.
We're going to watch the Space Museum, and next time we'll let you know what we thought about it. Bye.
Bye. Time wins.